Spanish language theater production featuring a character in blackface? Is South Florida prepared for another hurricane season? And FEMA spends millions on a half-empty floating hotel. Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup. I'm Jessica Bakeman. A Spanish language theater in Miami reverses course on its decision to feature a blackface character. But Afro-Latinos here say the situation shows how racism persists in local Latin American communities. We'll also hear about what changes are in store after Hurricane Irma led to widespread destruction in the Florida Keys and a tragedy at a nursing home in Broward. Also today, a WLRN report found that the Florida government spent more on a cruise ship to house aid workers off the U.S. Virgin Islands than it gave directly to residents in need. All that and your phone calls coming up on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. And as always, thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Bakeman, in this week for Tom Hudson. A Spanish language play that has been showing since January at a theater in Little Havana, until recently featured a fair-skinned actress wearing brown face makeup and overdrawn big red lips. Blackface was once popular in racist minstrel shows in the U.S., but has since been regarded unacceptable. It's still performed regularly in Spanish language entertainment. The theater, called Teatro Trail, decided to eliminate blackface from the play after an El Nuevo Herald report called out the use of blackface. But as we'll discuss more, Afro-Latinos in Miami say the play is a window into the racism that exists in local Latin American communities. Rudy Vizcaíno is half Dominican and half Cuban, and he has dark brown skin. He chairs the Dominican American National Foundation.
When I wore a t-shirt that said, "I am the Afro-Latino American dream." And then I remember bumping into an uncle of mine that's Cuban. He told me, "Take off that shirt. You're not African." And I said, "Hey, Theo, you know, last time I checked, you know."
Are you one of the audience members who went to see the play showing in Little Havana? Do you identify as Afro-Cuban or Afro-Latino? And have you experienced racism in Latino communities here? What are your thoughts on blackface in Spanish language entertainment? We want to hear from you. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Here in the studio with me, I have WLRN reporter Nadej Green. Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Jessica.
And also Brenda Medina, reporter for the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. Thank you so much, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
So, Brenda, catch us up here. What was this play about, and how was it received by audiences since it's been playing since January?
So the play is about three friends who live in a condo in Hialeah. They're older women, they're widowers, and they're planning to go on a cruise. And the play revolves around their plans to go, and then when they come back, the memories of the cruise. I was contacted at the paper, and some editors were contacted because a few people went to see the play and they saw the character in blackface and they were offended by it. One of them was a history teacher. So I started, you know, asking questions about it, calling the people involved with the play. And I realized that it had been playing for 5 months to sold out audiences every weekend, and the director, the actress, everyone involved with the play told me that people loved it, that they hadn't heard any complaints, that no one ever brought up the fact that someone was in blackface. And I went to see the play, and that's not the only problem with the play. It also promotes a lot of stereotypes, but apparently people loved it.
So what did the director say, and what did the actress say in defense of the production?
They said that it was normal, that it was part of the Cuban culture, of the teatro vernacular theater in Cuban culture, that this was a traditional character, El Negrito Cubano. And the actress told me she has been playing similar characters for years in Miami.
Wow.
Without any issues. And when I brought up the possibility of this being offensive to many people here, she said that one of her most shocking quotes was that people now complain for everything.
And after you did that report, the theater decided to remove the blackface character or have the character continue in the play, but without blackface. Is that right?
I was very surprised. The character has continued in the play. She's a very well-known actress in, you know, theater and even telenovelas in the United States, in Miami. But they have removed the blackface makeup, and they say that they are modifying the text in the play to change certain lines. I haven't been back to the play since they made the changes, but I assume one of the most egregious joking lines was the blackface actress would jump on stage, pounding her chest and opening her legs wide, you know, wide open, and saying that we're going to drink, dance, and have fun like three gorillas, which is very problematic as well. I'm assuming that they're going to get rid of that line. I want to go back and see what they have changed, but so far there is no use of blackface anymore.
Well, that goes to show you the power of local journalism. Nadege Green, you spoke with Afro-Latinos in South Florida about this production. What was their overall sentiment?
Everyone I spoke to was like, this is blatant racism. This is dehumanizing for Black people across the diaspora. And it's another way to see Blackness as either comedy or something to be made fun of, something less than, something inferior. And Brenda's story, Brenda asked, you know, if you wanted a Black character, why would you not hire an Afro-Latina? We are not, you know, they're everywhere. They're here in Miami, Florida, too. And the answer is like, well, we couldn't find one. But in all honesty, like, those sort of characters were not designed for Black people to play, right? It was designed to make fun of Black people. And any sort of assertion that blackface somehow is a way to celebrate Black people is just false and not true.
Well, Brenda said that, you know, the response she got was that this is a traditional character in Cuban theater. Can you give us a historical context?
Blackface was a traditional character in American theater, right, as well. It was part of minstrel shows. It was Mammy. It was Uncle Buck. It was very much part of our history as well here in the U.S. And that was dehumanizing as well. And
but
just because
different?
Something is tradition does not make it right. There are many things we can point to that have been tradition that is not okay in 2018.
Right. So, I'm just wondering what's different in terms of, like, how did we get to the point in the U.S. where we realize this is absolutely not okay, but they're not at that point with Cuban theater?
I don't know that they're not at that point in Cuban theater, because blackface typically isn't shown in Cuban theater in Cuba as much anymore either. But in Spanish language media, even though it still exists, you do have a backlash. People push back against this all the time. We've seen it in Peru, in Ecuador, in Brazil. Earlier this year, Brazil, Afro-Brazilians were very upset about blackface among samba dancers. In Colombia, you had a blackface soldier on TV. The Afro-Colombian community in Colombia stood up and said, that is not okay. That is not a representation of us. He must come off the airs. And they got that character off the air. So it's not that we're not seeing sort of this pushback, but I think very much like in the U.S., do we listen to Black voices? Do we center Black voices? And when someone tells you this is offensive, will you stop if the majority doesn't see it that way? And so all of that is part of the conversation.
Brenda?
Yes, and what I find interesting is I have gotten dozens of emails from people who don't agree with our story and, you know, what we're saying. Saying that we're exaggerating, that this is normal, that we are trying to offend, that calling me racist because I'm offending Cubans by comparing this to blackface in the United States. And they often tell me that there is a difference because in their view, the blackface character in Cuban vernacular theater is somehow social criticism for racism. And
they're saying it's like satire.
Yes. And I had this person write me an email that essentially said, you know, it's not only Black people we make fun of. It's also we group all Spanish immigrants into this Galician immigrant character. And we also make fun of Asian people by, you know, having this Chinese, quote unquote, character. So it's not only Black people. And I'm like, all of
what's your response to that?
Yeah, all of them are wrong. All of this is wrong. Plus, you know, Black people have been oppressed and enslaved for centuries in Latin America and in the United States. So you cannot compare, you know, having someone talking with an exaggerated Spanish accent to making fun of an entire race by painting a white actor or actress black and having them promote all these stereotypes about black people being stupid and being lazy, you know, and not being good for other than hard labor and sex. That's essentially what the play promotes.
Well, let's go to the phones. We're getting a call from Junior in Fort Lauderdale. Junior, you're on the radio.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Anytime. I wanted to add to the young lady who spoke about the question in regards to, you know, what makes it okay for the black race to happen in the Hispanic community. You know, I'm Dominican. I'm of, you know, darker skin. And all my life, I've actually have grown with that kind of internalized racism that happens in our community so much that other dark-skinned Hispanics have, you know, kind of feel the same about each other. They don't view themselves as having African heritage. And I think somehow coming to the States makes them think that, you know, we're Hispanic. We're not, you know, we're not anything else. And I think the black identity has somehow is invisible in the Hispanic community within the black culture, that they almost, when they see blackface happening, it's almost okay. I mean, I just saw a blackface comedian, Alexis Valdez, in the Mega Channel like last year. And that's a hugely popular show within Cuban Americans, Puerto Rican Americans. And I was just shocked. I'm just like, this is still happening. And it was 2017. So I'm so happy that you guys are finally talking about it, because it is offensive and it's happening, but it's somehow, it's almost invisible in the culture if it's not talked about.
Junior, how did that make you feel when you were growing up?
You know, it's so funny because I remember the very first time that I'm not different, but we're still diverse in the Dominican Republic, but, you know, we had tourists come to the area. I'm from Casa de Campo in that area, and they were white, and they, you know, they saw that's the white girl, and we never say, like, oh, that person's white and that person's black. I mean, that's more when I came here to the States when I was 7 years old, and they kept using it. I'm just like, oh, there's a difference. And when I went to school, in the Bronx, everyone was, you know, Hispanic. And then between the Hispanics, you can see the difference and people talking about,
right? Okay.
You know, who's black.
Well, thank you so much, Junior, for calling in. We're going to try to get to another call here, but thank you so much for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Okay, bye. Chaz from Coral Gables, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I'd like to echo what Junior says. I think this is great that you guys are talking about this. I want to remind everyone who's listening that Cuba is actually historically the penultimate country, or I should say it wasn't a country when it had institutionalized slavery, but it was a Spanish colony, and it was the penultimate territory in the world that actually had viable institutionalized slavery. So I speak to you as you know, I'm first generation American. My parents came over from Cuba, and I've lived with the inconsistencies. I've lived with this kind of quaint philosophy that there is no black and there is no white, there is no brown in Cuba. We're all Cuban because we were forged into this political entity, which is just, it's bunk.
Right.
It's absolute
bunk.
Well,
thank you so much, Chaz, for that comment. I appreciate it. Brenda or Nadej, would you like to respond?
You know, I think it's very important, like when we talk about race, especially that we consider, like, especially here in the U.S., we talk about race in the binary, black or white American. But in the context of South Florida, that's not actually our reality, right? You are dealing with immigrants from different parts of Latin America and the Caribbean, and race there also exists. So it is very real to have white Cubans and have black Cubans and everything in between. Same thing for Venezuelan, same thing for Puerto Rican, same thing for Dominican. And along that spectrum, you will find that people's lived experiences are different depending on the complexion of their skin tone. And we don't often have those very real conversations because when I spoke to Afro-Latinos here in South Florida, they often say that we feel invisible. We are not represented in government. We're not represented in the higher echelon of the identity here in South Florida, because typically when we think Latino or Hispanic, which is the term predominantly used, we think white Cuban.
So what's happening to try to make this better? Are there organizations or people who are talking about this a lot and trying to improve upon this?
Not a lot, but there are organizations and people who are talking about this. There's this group that formed last year called Afro-Latinos Professional Network in Miami. It's informal, but they're trying to give more visibility to the wide range of Afro-Latinos doing great stuff here in Miami, and they're talking about it. There is also actually the theater, one of the aside from the changes that they made in the play, they're putting together a conference in Spanish on June 28th, I believe. I can check for you. But it's being organized by the Ernesto Gamboa Project, and is a project that is looking to talk about these issues and bring more visibility to, you know, the struggle of Afro-Latinos in the United States and in Latin America.
Okay, let's hear what Daniel has to say in Palm Beach Gardens. Hey, hello. Daniel.
Hello, thank you for having me on the air. I'd love to make a comment about Argentina in this case. The issue of blacks being downgraded in this way and the insensitivity is very widespread. In Argentina, for example, to date, schools, I'm talking about primary schools, will have little kids up on stage, black painting faces of the Negro Candombero, which is a throwback basically to the black population living on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, for example, or the Uruguayan black that typically played music on the streets. This is done very naively in some cases, and maybe not considered racist, but it is very much racist. And I think the sensitivity to these issues has not really been dealt with in much of Latin America.
That's a great point, Daniel. Thank you so much for your call. Let's get Ray on from Hialeah. Ray?
Hey, how's it going? I'm a Afro-Cuban. I've been living in Miami for the past 20 years. I came to this great country when I was 8 years old from Cuba. And this ideology when it comes to black faces, it's been going on for a really long time. And I'm glad that it put light to this due to the fact that it's time for a change. I live and I was born over there, and some people even tell me to my face that you can't be Cuban because you're actually black, because they've never seen a black person in Cuba or a black person in this country from Cuba. And that's appalling. I always ask myself, wow, it's like, how can you believe that? And my always question is, like, how you don't see one of the biggest trade routes through Cuba, and there's always black people there. And they say, oh, no, they can be. I've never seen a black Cuban before. And this ideology, when it comes to, is anybody who's from other countries or even from this European or American, they say, oh, you can't be Cuban because you're black.
Right. Nadezh, I think you heard something similar from some of the people you spoke with.
Right. I mean, across the board, all the Afro-Latinos that I speak with and some of my friends who are Afro-Latino, I'll tell you, when they speak Spanish in Miami, specifically to like someone who is a white Hispanic person, the person is always shocked, like, you speak Spanish. And I spoke to Nerida Rodriguez, who is Afro-Cuban, born in Cuba. She's 66 years old. And she was like, that is funny to her, because when you go to Cuba or when you go to Puerto Rico, when you go to Dominican Republic, it is full of people who are of African descent, dark-skinned people. So the fact that when you come to Miami, people are shocked, who are in the Hispanic or Latino community, who are white passing or white, and say, oh, you speak Spanish. There's, again, that erasure, that subtle erasure that happens, that this too cannot be your culture.
Okay, let's go to Yvette, who's calling from South Beach. Hey, Yvette.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and congratulations, ladies. And thank you for sharing, for the voices. I'd just like to comment on, I've been hearing a lot of comments on, there's a new movement happening, or like as far as Afro-Latinos coming out of the woodwork, more or less. I feel that we are, as Afro-Latino Cuban-American woman, we are, because our parents, as first generation, actually, Americans living here, we're seeing things in a different perspective. We're living the both cultures, both as black women and as Afro-Latino women. We're living different experiences as far as what Nadezh mentioned, the speaking Spanish, when they were like so shocked So then we, as far as this movement that's happening, we're taking it upon ourselves because our parents, I guess, they, you know, they were living in a different, in the bubble, and we're seeing it from a different perspective. So I'm very happy that this conversation is happening. And it's not an attack, and it's not like, you know, it's just a conversation that needs to happen. And blackface cannot happen anymore in the United States or anywhere. And, you know, I'm just very happy, and congratulations to all of you, and thanks for WLRN for airing this.
Well, thanks so much for your call, Yvette. Brenda, respond to that. You got some emails or calls from people saying, you know, that it wasn't appropriate for you to write what you wrote about calling out blackface in the play. And as Yvette said, you know, this is something we do need to be talking about and calling out.
I think that there's a lot of people in this community. There are a lot of people who are very comfortable with the status quo. And there are a lot of people who benefit from the status quo, right? So for an actress to say, I don't know any black actresses who can play this character, but you have been getting the, you know, getting the roles for so many years and making the money that comes with the roles. It's not in your best interest to know any black actresses who could play black characters. So I think we do need to challenge these ideas, because I think it's very problematic that when I talk to my I talk very openly about the racism going on in my own community. I'm Dominican. And when I talk to friends from Colombia, Argentina, Peru about this, their answers are very shocking, because I have had friends who tell me, we don't have those issues in our countries because we don't have black people.
Hmm.
And that is not true. There are people of African descent in every country in Latin America, because there was slavery in every country in Latin America. And for them to say that we simply don't have those issues because we don't have black people is erasing the identity and a struggle of entire groups of people. And we need to talk about that, because those are the people who haven't had their voice heard for centuries. And it's not that it doesn't bother Afro-Latino people, is that they have never been able to say it.
Nadege Green, what does this say about our community divides, where you can have a play with a blackface character selling out, and on the other side, there's this rightful outrage that this is happening at all?
I mean, I say this all of the time, that Miami is incredibly segregated. You can live in a bubble here. And in this case, you can live in a bubble that is only in Spanish. And so this can happen in this bubble, and no one else will interact with it. No one else will see it for context, right? So it says that we're very segregated, and it also says that we don't know each other very well. It says that we are still not together. And beyond blackface, what does this mean in the larger context when we're talking about race, racism, and power structures here in Miami and white identity? One of the things that Professor Danielle Cleland said, an FIU professor who's Afro-Puerto Rican, is you also need to look at how this lives beyond not just the character, but how people interact with black people in Miami. And so if the power structure in Miami is predominantly white Cuban, and you have an issue of race and identity that is happening that is not often spoken about, what does that look like for socioeconomic outcomes, right? If you're darker skinned and you're black Cuban, what does that look like if you're trying to apply for a job in an entity that is predominantly white, Hispanic here in South Florida? And so it is broadening the conversation, not just on a character, but actually what is the lived experiences of navigating spaces where we act like racism doesn't exist.
Well, this is obviously a very lively conversation from you both and our callers, and we can continue that conversation on Twitter at WLRN. Thank you so much, Nadege Green, WLRN reporter, and also Brenda Medina from the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald, for being a part of this conversation today.
Thank you so much.
And still to come, today is the official start of the 2018 Atlantic hurricane season. Do you feel prepared? Did you learn any lessons from Hurricane Irma that has changed the way you're getting ready this year? Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Jessica Bakeman, in this week for Tom Hudson. It's hard to believe it, but we're already here again. Today marks the official start of the 2018 Atlantic hurricane season. The National Hurricane Center predicts that we'll see 10 to 16 named storms this season, and 5 to 9 of those could be hurricanes. Many people in South Florida and our neighbors in the Caribbean are still recovering from last year's major hurricanes, Irma and Maria. Later in the program, we'll talk about the effects of Maria in Puerto Rico and a new study that shows a much higher death toll on the island than what the government initially reported. In the Florida Keys, there's an ongoing effort to clean up and rebuild after Irma. And there's a new statewide policy requiring generators at nursing homes after a tragedy in Broward County last year. Today also starts a week-long sales tax holiday on hurricane supplies. Greg McClendon from Miami is going to spend at least $100 on his supplies. He sent us a voice memo with some of the items on his list.
Lots of water and batteries, lots of batteries, ice, pork and beans, snacks, and did I mention water?
We also heard from Lloyd Brown. He's the director of Wildlife Rescue in Miami-Dade County, and he had this reminder.
60% of households in the United States have some sort of family member that may be considered a pet. You must remember these family members in making your family disaster plan. If you plan to evacuate to a shelter, remember, not all shelters will be animal friendly. Those which are will fill up first.
Tell us about your hurricane preparations. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet at us at WLRN. Katie Swatulski, WLRN's Broward County reporter, joins me here in studio. Thanks, Katie.
Hi, Jessica.
We also have Jenny Stiletovich, the environment reporter for the Miami Herald, who's joining us from our studio at the Miami Herald office in Doral. Thanks, Jenny, for coming on.
Thank you.
And we also have Nancy Klinginer, who covers the Florida Keys for WLRN from our studios in Key West. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Jessica.
So you all have been covering some hurricane conferences, finding out what the local counties here plan to do heading into this year, and doing a little bit of looking back on last year. What can we learn from it? Let's start with Jenny. Can you tell us what kind of season we're looking at here?
Yeah, so forecasters are saying we're going to be a little active, but closer to normal and not as bad, you know, fingers crossed, as last year.
Okay, and what models should we be following? I know there's always the cone of uncertainty that we keep an eye on. What should we be watching for?
Well, the Hurricane Center actually has several new graphics this year that might make it easier for people to understand the hazards. The cone, for one thing, is getting smaller because their forecast tracks have been more accurate, and that cone is based on a 5-year history of accuracy. It can be a little confusing because the cone doesn't really show you hazards. It's just a risk assessment. So when it comes to hazards, there are other things you can look at. One of the things that they've rolled out is a flood map that's going to be included in advisories this year. So you'll be able to zoom in and out and actually look at their forecast for flooding. There's also a wind arrival map that's a little different this year. It's gonna act sort of like a Google Drive map, where it gives you the earliest estimated time of wind arrivals and the actual estimated time. And then overlaid on that is sort of the odds for how accurate that they expect that to be.
Wow, so that sounds like some new technological tools that people can look at to see how, you know, a potential storm or hurricane is going to maybe affect them where they live.
Right, and that actually, too, is different than models. You reference models. There are all kinds of models out there. The Hurricane Center hates it when people look at those sort of spaghetti models, but we all can't help ourselves.
We all hate it, too, but we have to.
Right. So there's, you know, the European model is always one that seems to be more accurate. And then the Hurricane Center's model, they say, has been performing really well, too.
Well, Katie Swatulski, WLRN's Broward County reporter, you've been reporting on what Broward is doing to prepare. And it's, I think we have some new people at the helm in Broward County. Can you tell us about that?
We do. Broward County actually just named Tracy Jackson as the new director of Regional Public Safety and Emergency Services, which means he's going to be addressing the entirety of the regional 911 system in Broward, as well as emergency management. And that was actually just named a few weeks ago, back on May 9th. So we're going to have a new person. The county's been reviewing applications since earlier this year. So this was not entirely unexpected.
Was that something that they just happened to have an opening because of a retirement or something? Or how did that come about?
You know, there's a little bit of a change at the helm in general right now in Broward County's, you know, emergency management system. A few people have been interim directors, and so this is a more permanent person in at the helm.
And the county's emergency management assisted in the wake of the February 14th shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. How does that impact the county's ability to respond to another major storm if we have one this year?
You know, it means that the Emergency Management Division is still using some of its resources for ongoing Marjorie Stoneman Douglas relief and programs and helping families. And actually, if you think back to about 2 years ago, you know, there was Hurricane Matthew, and then there was the shooting at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. And that was the first time in over a decade that, you know, the Broward County Emergency Management has really had to go into an emergency mode that's not storm related. And so after that, then there was Irma, and now Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
So they've done this before.
So this is, you know, they're feeling a little strapped, I think. But, it, you know, it just means they're going to wear two hats. They're fully trying to prepare for storm season, but they're also still thinking in terms of what ongoing community and family relief is looking like.
Well, I'm going to talk to you, Nancy Klingener, about what's happening in the Keys in just a minute. But first, let's hear from Josh in West Palm Beach. Hey, Josh.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to call in and talk about some of the things I've been doing for hurricane preparedness.
Yeah, tell us.
And one of the things my wife and I noticed a couple of years back, I think it was Hurricane Matthew, is, you know, obviously lots and lots of water bottles being purchased for water. And we ended up going with a water filter. There's lots of water filters out there, relatively inexpensive, and don't rely on battery power, just a filter. And I think we got ours for $20, and it filters up to 1 million gallons. It's a great way to have limitless fresh water, and for $20. And
that's something that you do ahead of a storm to prepare?
Yeah, we're campers, and so it's something we use outside of hurricane preparedness, but it's something you can also use during hurricane, and then you don't have to battle the lines or worry about running out of water.
Right.
Because you can filter your own water.
Right. Well, thank you, Josh, for that tip. We really appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Nancy Klingener, who is our Florida Keys reporter, certain parts of the Keys are still recovering from Hurricane Irma. How has that affected storm preparations in Monroe County?
Yeah, the emergency managers will tell you that they are aware that we are more vulnerable in some ways this year because we do have people who are still sort of camping out in their houses or living in FEMA trailers or, you know, have blue tarps over their roof. So they say that they'll probably take some protective actions this year that you might not have seen in previous years, just because they understand that those folks are vulnerable. But they also say we now have, you know, a population of tens of thousands of people who have dealt with the impacts of a Category 4 hurricane. So we are at least hopefully more experienced and ready to cope when the next storm comes.
Well, and isn't the county offering a new training course that has to do with evacuations? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, the new training course, which is also being offered in some of the other counties, is emergency response training. And it's going to be 32 hours in four-hour segments. And it will basically tell you how to be self-sufficient in a disaster zone, how to be safe, some basic first aid, since, you know, if 911 isn't available, the hospitals aren't open, you know, you really need to be able to cope with medical emergencies. So that kind of training isn't unique to the Keys. What's unique here is that they are using it as an incentive to get people to evacuate, because what they are offering is that if you go through this training and you're certified, then you will get a special golden ticket to return very quickly after a hurricane before they let the general public back in, you know, before maybe the water's all the way back up, before the internet and cell phone service is back. So their big fear is that so many people were so angry they couldn't get back for a week after the last storm that they will not evacuate before the next one.
So they were waiting. So people who live in the Keys were waiting for a week after Irma to be able to get back into their homes?
Key West and the Lower Keys, yes.
Okay. And speaking of this course and some of the technological tools, how are those going to potentially affect the decisions about evacuations in Dade or Broward? Jenny Stiletovich from the Miami Herald, can you tell us about that?
Sure. So the state meteorologist said at the governor's hurricane conference that they're going to be sort of more surgical about evacuations. and looking more closely at surge maps. I think there's a new emphasis on, you know, sometimes you can shelter in place, and they want to remind people that the shelters that they open should be a last resort. They're not meant to be really comfortable, or, you know, they don't have a lot of things that they can offer. It's just shelter and a cot, or not even a cot sometimes. So what they were saying is they don't want to, you know, have every year have these mass evacuations like they had last year that caused so many, many problems.
But last year, weren't like the governor and other people on TV saying, leave, take this storm seriously? Are they now saying too many people evacuated?
I don't think they're saying, I mean, every storm is different, you know, so when Irma was bearing down on us and it was as wide as the state, and you know, at one point it was aimed at Miami and then it made a sudden turn at the last minute. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was really it was a hard storm to call. And I think that they feel comfortable in their decision last year, although, you know, a lot of residents probably would disagree with that.
Yeah.
But the way it made the turn, you know, time is an element, too, when you have so many people down here evacuating up a very narrow state. There's just not a lot of alternatives for where to go.
Well, I know Irma was one of my first hurricanes down here, and it seemed like people were kind of, okay, let's go to Atlanta. Okay, let's go to Fort Myers. And then every time they went one way, the storm followed them. So it is one of those really unpredictable things.
Right, right. And the other thing, I mean, as Nancy pointed out, we just came off a really busy hurricane season. Last year, this time, we were in a completely different place. We hadn't had a major storm hit down here in a decade. I should also point out we have a new Hurricane Center director who started. And when
That's
I talked to him.
Miami-Dade?
Yes. The National Hurricane Center, which is based in Miami, has a new director. So he oversees all hurricane, or, you know, that center oversees all hurricane forecasts in the Atlantic Basin. But you know, we talked about this and you know, this kind of different attitude and how challenging it would be to kind of communicate the hazards and the threats this year versus last year. This year, you might have a little too much anxiety, a little hysteria. I think Alberto got us off to an early start.
Yeah.
And you know, you saw people really react to that. So it'll be interesting.
Well, Adrian from Miami has a question for the panel. Go ahead, Adrian.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question, and I'll take my answer off the air. This is for your panel. Is there any way that maybe you have a budget maybe like a budget for like a family of four to be prepared for, you know, any oncoming storms?
What do you think? Does anybody have a recommendation for that or an idea?
I asked a few residents yesterday, and it seems like for a single person or you know, trying to take care of a senior, a single senior citizen, the average budget seems to be between $100 and $200.
Per person.
So if you're looking at a family of four, you can try to keep that at, you know, $400, or you know, if you're buying things like a backup generator, a single backup generator can run in the 700s.
So yeah, I guess it's gonna depend on what you'll need in your specific situation, what you already have at home as far as being able to get through that. Well, thank you, Adrian, for your call. Katie, let's stay with you for a second. Last year, there was a tragedy in Broward County. 12 seniors died at Hollywood Hills Rehabilitation Center when, after Irma, the facility lost power. And I think the people there were feeling the effects of heat exhaustion. What's happening now? I think there have been some statewide changes to try to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Yes, that tragedy has hugely affected, I think, how all of Broward County is trying to prepare for this storm season. You know, Governor Rick Scott did sign a power bill for nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And, you know, it means they have to have an alternate source of power, but he loosened it originally. It doesn't have to just be a generator. So the state was trying to find ways to ensure, you know, that more of these facilities have backup power. The problem is when it comes to Broward County and even, you know, northern parts of Miami-Dade, there's so many nursing homes and assisted living facilities here that the trouble is really inspecting them. It's one thing to say, yep, I've got a generator on a piece of paper, but you can look on the Agency for Healthcare Administration's website, ACA, and you can look and find abuse and deficiency reports for your or your loved one's facility to see if they actually had an inspection, if the backup generator works, because, you know, at all costs, you really want to prevent that loss of air conditioning again for so long.
Well, thank you so much, Katie Swatowski, our WLRN Broward County reporter. And also thank you, Jenny Stiletovich and Nancy Klinginer from the Miami Herald and WLRN's Florida Keys reporter. Thanks for coming on. So the still to come on the Florida Roundup, the federal government spent millions on a half empty floating hotel to dock off the U.S. Virgin Islands after Hurricane Maria. That's less than what they gave directly to the victims of the storm to rebuild their homes. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Jessica Bakeman, in this week for Tom Hudson. This week, WLRN reported on a multi-million dollar deal between the Federal Emergency Management Agency and Carnival Cruise Lines to house federal aid workers and first responders off the coast of the U.S. Virgin Islands. But the floating hotel was half empty, and taxpayers footed the bill. The Carnival ship Fascination was docked in St. Croix for about 4 months in the aftermath of Hurricanes Irma and Maria, costing FEMA about $75 million. That's more than what the federal government gave directly to the residents of the U.S. Virgin Islands, which were devastated by last year's major hurricanes. Also revealed this week, many more people died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria than what the federal government has reported, about 70 times more. The official estimate was 64 deaths, but a new study from Harvard found it might actually be closer to 5,000. Here in the studio with me are WLRN reporter Danny Rivero and our America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Thanks for having us.
Danny, this was your report that we're referring to about the FEMA floating hotel. So tell us, is it common for FEMA to make this type of deal when they need housing for recovery efforts abroad?
So the short answer is no, and that's largely because these kind of situations, disasters of this scale, are not the most common things. There is some bit of a precedent with this. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, FEMA actually contracted three different Carnival ships to house victims of the storms in Louisiana and also in Alabama, and that became a little bit of a kerfuffle because those ships ended up being half empty. And they paid over $200 million for them over the course of 6 months. And they received a lot of bipartisan pushback in Congress.
So if this has happened before and they received that pushback, why did they do it again?
So part of the reasoning from the federal government, as far as I can understand it, because they haven't actually taken the time to talk to me about this, is that they wanted to get the first responders off of the land so that they wouldn't crowd the living conditions on the land. So they brought in a ship where they could house the workers that were coming in to provide aid.
Rather than having those workers stay in hotels where maybe the residents needed hotels because their homes were destroyed, they put them on a cruise ship because it's an island.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, what were those aid workers and first responders doing for 4 months?
Right. So they were involved in just the preliminary work of clearing debris, helping with the logistics of getting things to people, especially in rural areas, places where the roads might have been washed away. Really just the logistics of trying to run an emergency operation like that.
Tim Padgett, you obviously covered the impact of the storms of last year in the Caribbean and Latin America. And you recently spoke, or a couple months ago, you spoke with the tourism commissioner for the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right.
What did you learn? What's going on there with tourism?
Well, tourism is crucial to their economy. I mean, you're talking about a third of the U.S. Virgin Islands GDP, if not more. And so to get them back up to capacity, get their hotel rooms full again is crucial, and that's not going to happen until early next year. But a lot of the hotel rooms have been used by some of these relief workers that Danny's been talking about. So, you know, they're hoping to get, you know, that phased out. But it's going to take a while. I mean, when I talked with the tourism commissioner just a couple of months ago, they were still at 60% or more. Out of, you know, 60% of their hotel accommodations were offline, and so it's going to take until next year to get that rectified.
Wow. Danny Rivero, does FEMA negotiate these contracts for the housing for aid workers? Is that something they think about ahead of time in case a storm happens, or do they end up doing that after the storm happens?
So in the case of this particular contract, the indications we have are that this was actually negotiated after the fact. At this time, this was after Maria, there was three major hurricanes that had hit the United States. FEMA was, by most accounts, scrambling to figure out what they could get, and they negotiated this contract with Carnival to give them the control of the Fascination ship for about 4 months, to the tune of almost $75 million.
What has been the response to your story?
Well, I spoke to some people at Carnival, and they wanted to stress that as far as this deal was, they held up their end of the negotiation. They told me, you know, we provided the full use of the ship, and if FEMA, you know, put less than half the people that they could have put on it, that wasn't on us. That wasn't our obligation. That wasn't our responsibility. So they really want to distance themselves from any implication that, you know, they had any part in not filling up the ship to its capacity.
So shifting to the new report about the death toll in Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria, I remember hearing about this, reading about this. There were rumors that it was a lot more than 64 people who died. Why are we just getting this report now? I think it's from Harvard, Tim?
Right. I mean, it wasn't rumors. I mean, we knew back in November. In fact, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists here had been helping to fund the Center for Investigative Reporters in San Juan, Puerto Rico, in their own efforts to report the facts, not rumors, the facts that many, many more people, in the thousands perhaps, not just in the dozens, had died as a result of this hurricane. And as I said, there was a reporter, her name was Omaya Sosa Pascual, and she laid this out very, very plainly back then. And so it's a little surprising now that the media is just suddenly jumping to this because, oh, Harvard, you know, did a study. We knew about this back, as I said, a month after the hurricane or 2 months after the hurricane. And so we should be much farther along, you know, at this point than we are.
Danny Rivero?
Yeah, and just to add to what Tim was saying, you know, there was numerous reports by BuzzFeed, and in the BuzzFeed article, actually, they did a little bit of a survey of funeral homes around the island, and they found a very sharp uptick compared to past years. That was very early on in the process. New York Times did separate reporting that found that, you know, there was many more deaths than had happened in past years, and you know, this Harvard study is really just gaining a lot of attention, but this is something that basically everyone already knew.
Well, speaking of the media coverage, Vanity Fair wrote that the biggest disaster of the Trump administration may have already happened, referring to this in Puerto Rico. Tim Padgett, do you think that's a fair assessment?
I don't know if it's the tragedy, but it is a tragedy that how the Trump administration has approached this. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they took this very complacent approach to the death toll numbers there. President Trump kept insisting only 16 people had died in the hurricane. And what was just as tragic was that the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, sat there and sort of accepted it because he was terrified of offending Trump for fear of perhaps losing federal aid. But that's not how a head of state or the governor of a territory should approach these sorts of things. If you've got proof that your casualty numbers and your death toll is very high, you need to jump on that, because that does resonate with the United States Congress, for example, to get more aid to you. It's just flummoxes me how Rosselló could not have been jumping when he heard that these death toll figures were much, much higher than they really were.
Yeah, and just to reiterate that, I mean, heads of governments and states tend to err on the side of hyperbole,
exactly,
rather than understatement, because that will bring a lot more federal funding. I mean, Governor Rick Scott, he even faced criticism this last week for issuing a state of emergency for the entire state for tropical subtropical storm Alberto.
Right.
Which, you know, it didn't end up being that big of a...
It was a lot of rain, but not much else.
It wasn't much else, but he declared a state of emergency. And that's, I think, typically what you see from state leaders.
And that was you think that was to try to get more support or attention from the federal government?
in the case that something actually happens. What I'm saying is that you err on the side of hyperbole, right, typically.
And the other big lesson here is that you can't just count people who may have died directly that same day. You were just discussing with Katie Swatowski how the people here, for example, had died in the nursing home. Those are concomitant deaths that happen in these tragedies. And there were so many, for example, people who died of leptospirosis because of the flooding creating bacterial infections in Puerto Rico. Those are hurricane-related deaths, too. So there's a big lesson there in how we have to sort of, you know, holistically approach this.
Do you think that was a legitimate fear on behalf of the Puerto Rican governor, that if he was too critical of the president, that the federal government might not respond even more than they had, you know, already been criticized for not responding enough?
Oh, yes, because President Trump had made it very clear, especially during that first visit when he made, you know, did those cavalier tossing of paper towels to people. He had made it very clear that he was not going to give Puerto Rico much funding.
And yeah, and just to reiterate that, I mean, the Politico reported not too long ago that, you know, any money that the federal government is giving to Puerto Rico, if the cost runs over, then Puerto Rico would actually be responsible for feeding that back. And the White House made it very clear to Governor Rosselló that if he didn't accept that, they would cut funding.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Danny Rivero and Tim Padgett. That will do it for today's Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Today's Affrontato is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Mares. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Jessica Bakeman, in for Tom Hudson, who'll be back next week. Thanks for calling and listening to WLRN.